infallible proofs, and if they have many of them. Let's find out. I wonder. Before we jump into it, though, we need to look at some tools. Here are some tools that we're going to need to use during this lesson. Three are logical fallacies. We need to be able to identify these. A fallacy is an invalid way of thinking that leads to an unreliable conclusion. God doesn't think this way, we shouldn't either. That's what we talked about some last week. God thinks in a rational way. He is the standard for rational thought. By the way, if you want to learn to think rationally, read the Word of God. And as you read the Word of God, your mind will be straightened and you will think rationally. The first one is the fallacy of affirming the consequent. These are maybe unfamiliar terms to you. The second one is fallacy of equivocation, and the third one is straw man. Now, surely you've heard of straw man. We'll jump into the first one. Affirming the consequent fallacy. If you have a statement, usually cause and effect, this is the way it would go. If, symbolically, A. If A is true, then B is true. That's the way you would think. And then you would affirm that B is true. I have discovered that B is true. Therefore, A must be true. Now, that's not the usual way you do it, because this is wrong. The usual way you do it is this. If A is true, then B is true. I have just discovered that A is true, therefore B has to be true. Now, let me give you an example. If it is raining outside, then the grass is wet. Well, letter A up there in that first pattern, that's called the antecedent, and B is the consequent. Now, those are terms, you probably won't need those as you're talking to people, but it helps us maybe to look at this. A is the raining outside. If it is raining outside, then the grass is wet. You'd probably agree with that. Yeah. Ah, I have just discovered that the grass is wet. Therefore, it must be raining outside. No, it's not. There are other causes for the wet grass. The sprinkler could be on, the dew might be on the grass, it may have just stopped raining. There are other causes. That's why this is invalid. It's a fallacy. That's an invalid way to reason. But amazingly, the evolutionists, as they present their argument, they make this mistake constantly. And so we're going to see that a lot today, right from the textbook. Affirming the consequent. It may support the theory, that is, this if you find that it's the grass is wet, that might lead you to think that it is raining, but it doesn't prove it. It doesn't prove it. The second fallacy that's important for us to look at is equivocation. Equivocation is to change the meaning of a key term in your argument while you're making the argument. And the evolutionists do this as well. Let me give you an example. Suppose you know somebody who plays the flute very well. Just made up name. Lori plays the flute very well. The NFL wants good players to play for them. I think you see where this is going. Therefore, the NFL should want Lori to play for them. Now, this argument, now maybe that's the National Flute League. It could be. But you see, the word play, the meaning of the word play has changed in the midst of the argument. The evolutionists do the same thing. They change the meaning of a key word in the midst of the argument in order to get you to buy something that isn't right. So that's the equivocation fallacy. The last one that we'll look at this last tool that we'll need. It's called the straw man fallacy. That's where one participant in a discussion or argument simplifies or misrepresents the opponent's position in order to more easily defeat it. And when they do that, that's invalid. This happens an awful lot during political debates. One candidate will misrepresent the position of another one because it's easier to defeat it that way. Well, that's invalid. The point they might make might be okay, but it has nothing to do with the discussion. That's called the straw man fallacy. And that's something that we do not want to do as we look at the theory of evolution. We don't want to misrepresent it. That's one of the common charges that the evolutionists make against biblical Christians or creationists, is, oh, they're misrepresenting. They just don't understand. They don't understand real science. They don't understand. And we want to avoid doing that. So that's one major reason I'm going right to the textbook so that I don't misrepresent their position. And also, that doesn't make them immune either of misrepresenting biblical Christianity. I think we'll see an example of that next week. Okay, now, close your eyes because I need to skip over this slide and come back to it. All right, now this slide is just a reminder from last week. Christian faith is substantiated. In fact, we started out the song that we sang this morning, the first one. He is able, right. The first song we sang this morning, He is able. And the whole second side was infallible proofs. He raised people from the dead, and He healed people. He, on and on. All those infallible proofs. Christianity is substantiated. Our response then is that we should esteem all thy precepts concerning all things are right, and I hate every false way. But what about evolution? Can it withstand criticism? Can it withstand testing? I hope to show to you today, and some next week, and the rest of this quarter, that evolution is not. And the best I can say is that it is an unsubstantiated conjecture about what happened in the past. It's actually a faith. Hebrews 11:1 tells us what faith is. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, most of my life, I'd say at least half my life anyway, I did not comprehend what this verse is telling you. And since, let me explain to you how I miscomprehended it. Because of the structure here in English, it looked to me always like it's a parallel definition. Like sometimes you'd see in the book of Proverbs, you'd have a statement and then followed by another statement that says the same thing, only in different words. And so I would look at that and I'd say, the substance, well, that matches the evidence of things hoped for, and that would maybe match not seen. And that always led me to confusion, saying, you know, I don't understand this. And maybe you do, and if you do, thank you for bearing with me. What it's really saying is this, that faith is the substance of things hoped for. That is, you're hoping for something when you don't see the evidence. That is, the evidence of things not being seen. The gentleman who pointed this out to me, actually on the day, the very day that I met Lori, was John Whitcomb. He was giving a presentation at, and I went to see it, and he pointed this out. He actually applied it, and when he applied this verse, I was all offended because he was taking scripture and putting it where I thought it shouldn't be. But you'll see, I'll point it out to you today in just a moment. The evidence is not seen. Okay, whoops. Now here's why I want to go back to that slide that I skipped. Here's going to be the introduction or the definition, the textbook definition of evolution. Bear with me. But let me show you the common misconceptions. Okay, common misconceptions or misuses of evolution. One common misconception is that individual organisms evolve. That is not true. That is not what the evolutionists will tell you. Once you are, you don't evolve. Once a dog is born, it does not evolve. But yet, that misconception shows up in popular culture. It forms the backdrop of fiction, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Incredible Hulk. The background for those sorts of pop culture stories is that individuals evolve. And in this case, of course, they were evolving backward. Here, another misconception. Bacteria, you'll hear bacteria evolve a resistance to antibiotics. Well, no, it's not individual bacteria that develop a resistance. That's not what they're saying. I'll show you what they actually say in just a moment. Or insects evolving pesticide resistance. An individual cockroach does not develop a new resistance to pesticide. That's not what evolution is teaching. A second misconception, and you might be incredulous, just as I am incredulous, but the evolutionists will say, no, we are not saying that over time things become more complex. Just because we can walk around and talk and carry on good discussions and so on, and our distant ancestor, the single-celled glob, appears to be much simpler than we are, that's not necessarily more complex. Now you look at me and you think, what? Well, this is one of the things that the evolutionists will say, is that it is a misconception to claim that evolution teaches we become more complex over time. I find this incredulous. Maybe you do too. Let's go then to the textbook definition. Now we're going to skip back ahead. Evolution. Here's the first definition right from the textbook. It's a direct quote. Evolution is the process by which populations accumulate inherited changes over time. Now that's a mouthful. Notice that it says populations. That is, so if you have a herd of cows, the herd of cows may change characteristics over time, not the individuals themselves, but succeeding generations. You could see this maybe with, now we have a number of different breeds of cows. You got your Jersey cow, you got your Holstein cow, you got your Guernsey and your Swiss. Well, over time, the farmers have deliberately sought traits among parents, and they get new traits in these in the offspring. It's the changes from generation to generation, little changes. That's what they call evolution. That is microevolution. That is what they call microevolution, change on a little basis. They accumulate over time, that is, from one generation to the next. So, for instance, if during the lifetime, Bessie the cow steps in a hole and she breaks her leg, so the leg has to be amputated. Now she has only three legs. Well, you know her offspring will not have that trait. The offspring will still have four legs. That's not a trait that is inherited. So they're talking about things that are inherited, things that are learned through the lifetime of a creature, changes that happen to the creature over the lifetime. Those are not inherited sorts of things. Then they make this leap. The very next sentence in the textbook is this. Because of evolution, scientists think that all living things, from daisies to crocodiles to humans, share a common ancestor. This is often called macroevolution. This is also our first example of equivocation. Equivocation. They call both of these evolution. Because you look at microevolution, and you see, yes, microevolution happens, then obviously you believe that macroevolution happens. They're both evolution, which is one reason I strenuously object to even calling that first thing microevolution, because it lends to this equivocation. It's fallacious to do that. So they make the first statement, then they make the second statement here. Because of evolution, scientists think that all living things, from daisies to crocodiles to humans, share a common ancestor. And then they go on to try to demonstrate the truth of the second statement. That's here in the textbook. They illustrate this then with these nice illustrations. And so just like National Geographic, those beautiful pictures, and then the TV specials, the National Geographic specials, they have the beautiful photography, and then they have the very authoritative voice that tells you billions of years ago, and so on. The textbook is full of these very nice-looking illustrations. So they illustrate this concept, and you can even see it up there in the upper left-hand corner. There's the quotation that I just typed out for you. They call this the spiral of life. And when I was going through grade school, I don't recall ever seeing this. This is a new kind of a representation, I think. But as time goes on, life just continues to go through this path, and I really don't even see the purpose of drawing it in a circle or a spiral, maybe because it fits on the page better. I don't know. But you see over here, 540 million years ago, there were life started in the waters, and then 500 million years ago, something else happened, and then just kind of gotten, well, the evolutionists would deny that it's getting more complex, but to the uninitiated like us, it looks like it's getting more complex. But anyway, finally things crawl up onto the land up there a few million years ago, and then they get more complex, and mammals appear, and here's one right over here. You see, mammals developed on the land, according to the evolutionist, but you have whales down there in the ocean. Ah, clearly, though, sometime after mammals evolved on land, some of them had to crawl back into the ocean. So you see the whale right there. He's going back into the ocean. This is macroevolution, an illustration of it. So far, they haven't proven it, have they? They haven't offered any proof. So now they produce evidences of evolution. The textbook here offers two evidences of evolution. They offer up what they call the fossil record, and then they compare organisms. And they will use this as reasons to believe evolution. Now, these are not all the evidences, but these are the main ones that they use. The first statement they make then about the fossil record. Fossils provide a historical sequence of life known as the fossil record. There's an assumption in here. What is it? Sequence. That's exactly right. Sequence. The assumption is that the fossils are in a particular sequence and that they represent changes over long periods of time. That's the assumption. If that is not true, then everything else that they say about the fossils falls apart. This is an assumption. They claim that they call it the fossil record. It's really just all the fossils buried in the dirt. When you put the word record with it, then that carries with it the notion that it is ordered in a sequence. Just like your record book when you have a business or your home finances. Oh, that's your record book. Things are ordered in a sequence. They point to the fossil evidence and they say it's ordered in a sequence. Several weeks from now, we will look at, in more detail, the fossil record as it is. But anyway, the assumption is that fossils near the surface are very similar looking to present-day organisms. And the fossils that are deeper down are more different or less like the present-day organisms. I say that's an assumption because the fossils in the dirt usually don't show that. But that's a problem that that they have yet to overcome. But it's an assumption. So here is a diagram that they use. So far, all diagrams. No photographs in this textbook on this stuff. It's all diagrams. So here they show an illustration of the fossil record. They show that time elapses going from bottom to top. So along the top there, you see all these, all the ends of these branches, if you can, they call it the tree of life. And across the top, those are all the things that are still alive today, all the different kinds of organisms, whether it's the daisies or the crocodiles or the humans, all along the top there, those are the things that are alive today. As you look further down, then coming back down, those are, when you come to the end of a line, that's something that's gone extinct. All right? And so eventually you see in this diagram, everything comes together down to a single ancestor there at the bottom, that single line. So this is, in a nutshell, the theory of macroevolution. Now this is where Dr. John Whitcomb applied Hebrews 11:1. And he said, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This over here is a representation of what they actually find. You see, there are lots of gaps in the fossil record. There are lots of fossils that they find that don't seem to be connected to anything else. You've got the things that exist across the top, and then lots of gaps. There's no connection they find in the fossil record. So this is what they keep referring to as the missing link. All these dimly illuminated lines in here, those are the missing links. We need to find these transitional fossils where we see something that's half reptile and half chicken. We need to find these things. So they keep looking and looking and looking. Charles Darwin said that, well, I expect to find lots of these missing links. But really, you know, if we don't find them, that would cast a lot of doubt on this theory. So this is where Dr. Whitcomb said, the evidence is not seen. Their faith does not have evidence. You don't see the evidence. As a case study, the textbook uses whales. I pointed out the whales. All right, they claim that mammals evolved on the land. But yet now you have, today, mammals swimming around in the oceans. You have the whales and the porpoises swimming around in the oceans. Ah, but look. You see, inside these whales, they're mammals, you can look inside, and you see what looks like remnants of little hind legs. They've got the front legs, like most mammals, but they don't have back legs. But if you look inside, you do a little autopsy on them, you'll find what looks like hind legs. Not very big, not very complete, but you find them. And they call them vestigial limbs. They say that these are remnants. See, this shows that they used to walk around on land. But as they climbed back into the water, they didn't need them, and so they didn't use them anymore, and they kind of shrank. So this is an illustration right from the textbook again. Well, they had a problem with this. They could not find any intermediate fossils that showed a progression from land animals back into whales, as they said. So here's their story, though. Over millions of years, whales evolved from dog-like land dwellers into sea-dwelling organisms. That's a paraphrase from the book. Here's a quote from the textbook. However, during the 1980s and the 1990s, several fossils of whale ancestors were discovered. These discoveries support a theory of whale evolution. Okay, two things wrong with this. One is the statement there, several fossils of whale ancestors were found. How do you know they're whale ancestors? Were you there? Did you watch the breeding occur? How do you know they're whale ancestors? No, you just think they are. You're just saying they are. Secondly, these discoveries support a theory of whale evolution. Alert, here you go again. This is the affirming the consequent fallacy. If whales evolved from land animals, then we would expect to find fossils showing transitional forms. We find fossils showing transitional forms. Therefore, whales must have evolved from land animals. That gets it backwards. That's the fallacy of affirming the consequent. That might help make you think that that happened, but it certainly does not prove that it happened. They do not prove that it happened by doing this. That is a logical fallacy. So here are the pretty pictures. They say 55 million years ago, this is right from the textbook, here's a whale ancestor. Looks kind of like a dog. It might be a cat. Some kind of a mammal, though, lives on the land. And they find this in the fossil record, they say. They find fossils of this. Notice what they don't find. They don't find the hair color. They don't find how it looked or the musculature or the size of the ears. All they find is the bones, and not even all of those. So the most of this, this pretty picture, is just somebody's idea of what this might have looked like. To me, it looks kind of like a hyena. See the spots on it? See the face? I don't know. It kind of looks like a hyena. Hyenas are alive today. In fact, he's there eating carrion. So that was, they say, 55 million years ago. 5 million years later, we find bones like this. Now this one, you see, is kind of chunky, and he's got shorter arms and legs, and his tail is kind of chunkier. He's obviously looking like he likes to be in the water more. You can tell that because of the webbed feet, that he likes to be in the water. Uh-oh, I see somebody shaking her head up here. What's wrong with webbed feet in this picture? How do you know it was there? You don't find the webbing in the fossils. You find the bones. Okay, so anyway, then 4 million years later, we find a fossil like this. Find the bones, and clearly this one spent much more time in the water. But he still has front legs, and he's still got back legs, but now he's got this tail that helps him whoosh around. The tail of a whale has a special name. Fluke, yes, it's a fluke. Yeah, this one's got flukes. And then another 6 million years, and you have something that looks, well, kind of like a modern whale. You got front flippers, and here they highlighted the fingers on the front flippers. And you got little stubby things there in the back for, you know, that's what's left of the back legs. But, you know, it kind of looks like a whale. So that's a really, really neat sequence that they show. This is amazing. We might be inclined to believe their story. I mean, look at the sequence, 55 million years, and then 50 million years, and 46 million years, and 40 million years. And apart from the fact, never mind the fact that the first one looks like a hyena, which we have today, and the second one kind of looks like, you know, it's not too different from an otter that we have today, and the last one kind of looks like a whale. This one right here, that's really the key. That would be the transitional fossil right there. If you find one of those, oh, wow, maybe there would be something to it, but it would still be fallacious. It doesn't prove it. But it turns out that this fossil isn't even real. What they found did not include the tail. But they needed a fossil. They needed an example to show the transition. And this was a likely one. They said, well, look, if we just draw the tail, we know it's there. The fossil they found doesn't have the tail on it. That's just the cartoonist who drew the picture. Faith. It's the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. They didn't see it, but they hoped for it. It was fiction. Well, the next thing that the evolutionists present as evidence, again, now, they're very careful in the textbook. They don't say that it proves evolution is true. And I will grant them that that's good, that's accurate. But the way they present it to these eighth graders, got any eighth graders here? There's one. The way they present it to the eighth grader, they really don't endorse or allow for any alternative. They just present it as, this is the way it is. So they say, here's another evidence of evolution. We can look at various organisms. So they say, well, look at mammals. If, and I'll phrase it again like this, they'll say, if we came from a common ancestor, if we all had the same great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, all of us mammals, then we would expect there would be some similarities among the mammals. And so they look at the structure, say, of the arm. And so the human arm has those kinds of bones in them, and you can even name them. You probably learn them. And by the time you get to my age, you forget what the names are. Tibia and fibula and all those other. All right. Did I get the right names there? Oh, that was the leg. Sorry. That was the leg. Radius and ulna. There we go. Anyway. So you got the radius and the ulna, and you've got all these little bones. And look, if you do an X-ray of a cat leg, it kind of has the same pattern of bones in there. Maybe not exactly the same number, but kind of the same pattern. You look at the dolphin flipper. Now, dolphins, they're way over there in the water. They kind of, well, look, same kinds of things. And especially if you draw the picture with color coding the bones like that, then it makes obvious, yes, you can see a similarity, even a bat wing. But again, it's not proof. It could be an indication, say, of common needs. Could be an indication of a common designer, a common creator. I thought about, how would Balaam's donkey talk to him if the donkey didn't have a mouth, lips, teeth, throat, diaphragm? How would she have talked to him if she didn't have those things? Would she have vibrated a tail? I don't know, but she needed, when God needed the donkey to talk to Balaam, she talked. Perhaps that was the only reason that he gave her those things from the beginning, because he needed her to talk to Balaam. Common designer, perhaps. This doesn't prove evolution. Another thing that they use is embryos. You know what an embryo is? When a creature begins as a single cell and begins to divide, and the little blob of cells that doesn't show anything yet, that's an embryo all the way up until, I don't know, they keep redefining, I guess, when a person isn't, or when the embryo isn't an embryo anymore and it turns into a chicken. So they make these drawings then of, let's compare the embryo of a chicken, a rabbit, and a human, these vertebrates. They call them vertebrates because they look awfully similar. Vertebrates are animals that have a spine. Right. We would like to have politicians like that. This is a subset of a bigger picture that was made by a man named Haeckel back in the late 19th century. He had not only those, but he had several other creatures. And he showed, this is remarkable. At this stage in life, all of these embryos look about the same. Look, they've all got eyes. There's a spot for the eye, a spot for the eye, and a spot for the eye. And you got an ear, ear, ear. You have a tail. Look, they all have tails. Even people have tails. Look at that. And arms and legs and look at these gill slits right here. See these folds right here? They used to call them gill slits, and sometimes they still do, right here. Those little things right there, those are gill slits. That shows that they evolved from fish. Well, there are a number of problems with this. One is you need to be suspect because they are drawings. They're not photographs. And an artist can do whatever they want to illustrate what they want to show. The gill slits are neither gills nor slits. even the human, you see the tail there? Well, that's not really a tail. It's just the end of the spinal cord. The spinal cord is extremely complicated. And God starts working on the spinal cord very early. Uh-oh, we're out of time. It's fiction. They do not look all that similar. The different parts are for different functions. The origin and influence of evolution. Evolution, the theory of evolution, is much older than Darwin. Many people, including his father and grandfather, espoused such beliefs. But he is credited, that is, Charles Darwin is credited with identifying natural selection as the mechanism by which evolution occurs. So now the book is going from macroevolution to teaching about microevolution, and they don't tell the student this. That's the equivocation. They're saying this is still evolution. So natural selection, here's the title of his book. You don't see the whole title of the book very often. Here's the whole title: On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. And then the subtitle is The Preservation of Favored Races. We can talk about that next time, I think. But there are four steps in natural selection that Charles Darwin identified. And you will agree with these, probably. These are things that you can observe. Different organisms have the ability to create, to produce many more offspring than are able to survive. Think of rabbits, okay? They breed like rabbits, many more rabbits than can possibly survive. Why is that? Well, you can think about that a little bit. But before we get to that, there's also the phenomenon of variation, genetic variation. When you have a litter of pups, you have a litter of bunny rabbits, they all don't look identical. They have slight variations, you know, change of hair color, change of ear length, variations. And these variations, like this poor deer, he's got a variation in his coloration. And based on what's going on in their environment, one set of characteristics might be able to survive better than others. They're better suited. And so he gets to the next point, a struggle to survive. Because the resources are scarce and there are dangerous adversaries, not all of the offspring are going to survive. And so the ones who do survive succeed and they reproduce, meaning that the characteristics that they had, the ones who survived, they propagated those characteristics. Now this you recognize and you say, yeah, I agree with that. That's what happens. That really does happen. That's what's called the survival of the fittest. And for thousands of years, farmers have been employing this to produce the different breeds of cattle for better milk or better meat or do it with dog breeding. And then here's where he goes a little bit further. And he says, now this can explain how new species develop. When two populations, the classic definition of a species, or two species, say, is if two individuals can successfully interbreed, whether it's horses or dogs or whatever, if two individuals can successfully interbreed, they are of the same species. That's the classic definition of a species. No, it's not a biblical definition. It's a classical definition. So it's possible, they say, that members or a population can diverge so much that they can't interbreed together. Suppose it happens like this. Geography would isolate a certain population. So a windy day, some finches are blown over the mountain, or they're blown off to an island off the coast of South America, away from the other population. And because of the different environment, because of natural selection then, different traits are brought forth. They call that adaptation. So as the environment changes, so may the population that lives there. And over many generations, the separated groups may adapt to better fit the environment. And eventually, they may not be able to interbreed with the ones back on the land, even if they were brought physically close. Here's the warning. They're equivocating on adapt. When we use the word adapt, we think about an individual. Rob, you get a new job that has different hours. And so you get up at a different time. You have adapted. You think about that all. Sure, we can adapt. The dog adapts. You get him a new kind of dog food, and he adapts. Yeah, he changes. That is not, though, what they're talking about. But when they use the word adapt, that gets us to think and gets us to agree with it. They are equivocating on that adaptation. That might be that, too. So these sorts of, when we talk about adapt, or an individual adapting, we're adapting, those are things that aren't passed on to the next generation. In order for evolution to happen, it has to be able to be inherited by the next generation. Where do the new traits come from? That's an important question. Natural selection can explain why we do not find species unsuited to their environment. You don't find cows living in Antarctica. And natural selection can tell us why we don't find cows living in Antarctica. They are not suited for their environment. But they cannot tell us. Natural selection does not explain why we do find species suited to their environments. Natural selection cannot explain where the new information comes from. It can only explain how information gets cut away. That's a big problem with evolution, and it's one that's ignored. There is other information, but this is what the kids are told in this quotation. Since Darwin's time, new evidence has been collected from many fields of science, and we'll look at some of those later in this quarter. Although scientists recognize that other mechanisms may also play a part in the evolution of a species, the theory of evolution by natural selection provides the most thorough explanation for the diversity of life on Earth. So they stop short of saying it has been proven, but they're telling the kids, this is the most thorough explanation. You should believe this. Just a summary of today. The fossil record does not prove evolution. That's a logical fallacy. Similar appearances among organisms also does not prove evolution. And natural selection can explain loss of traits, but not the origin of new traits. Your Bible verse for next week. Acts 1:3. That's the verse we looked at. Many infallible proofs, the Lord Jesus Christ. Many infallible proofs. Acts 1:3. Pastor, will you lead us in prayer?